He started here. He is here. No one knows New York better.
Geraldo.
77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
From the lakes of Minnesota to the hills of Tennessee, across the plains of Texas, from sea to shining sea, from Detroit down to Houston, and New York to L.A., where there's pride in every American heart, and it's time we stand and say,
the USA, happy birthday, United States Army. Today we salute the men and women in uniform, particularly the Army, because this is the Army's birthday. No disrespect to any of the other fine services. But today, in terms of more substantive topics, we're going to be addressing what's right or wrong with the president's new plan for fighting ISIS. You have to ask, folks, are we on the verge of a massive defeat or a brand new escalation in the never-ending war in Iraq? We'll be hearing from the Army's top general, Ray Odierno, who will be joining me live right here in our studio high above Madison Square Garden. We'll wish him and his mates happy birthday, happy 240th birthday, but then talk substantively about what the hell we're going to do about Iraq. Plus, two powerful public figures addressing the crucial issues facing urban America. And as we go through the program on this Thursday, June the 11th, I'll be telling you how differently those two public figures, the First Lady of the United States and the Police Commissioner of the City of New York, how differently they see what ails us and how, in a way, they're both right. But I want to start with the latest in the scene of that big prison break that's effectively made an armed camp out of parts of upstate New York. Now you have the Daily News had a great scoop. Did you see it, Noam? I loved her. She was my wife, and all of a sudden she cheated. The ex calls her a tramp. So this is by Edgar Sandoval, Nancy Dillon, and Corky Samazko in the Daily News talking about the interview they got with the ex-husband of the tailor, the jailhouse tailor suspected of aiding and abetting that great escape from Dannemora. He's telling these reporters, and he has no doubt that this 51-year-old woman, the prison tailor, he describes as his trampy, ex-wife tramp, was more than capable of being seduced into helping the two convicted killers who are still on the lam. Our buddy Joe Lotemplio from the Plattsburgh Press-Republican, the biggest newspaper in the area around Dannemora there, rejoins us. Joe, describe what's happening in and around Dannemora. Where the hell are these guys? Do they really have any idea, Joe?
Well, we are at the checkpoint on Route 374, about 8 or 9 miles west of Plattsburgh. As you can hear, there's a lot of traffic going on. Police have the road blocked off. There's a tremendous police presence about a mile or so up the road in an area around Trudeau Road where they've been searching heavily in the woods. And a police source there tells me they think this is it. They think they're closing in and this is going to be it.
So is it true they found food wrappers and that the dogs had a hit, that they scented something?
Yeah, they found a place where they believe to be bedded down, somewhere off Kennedy Road, I believe. But the dogs were having trouble picking up the scent because of the heavy rains overnight and into this morning. And the area they're searching, Geraldo, I got to tell you, it is really, really thick. You can't see a foot in front of you. And there's reportedly quicksand in the area. So it's rough terrain.
So why, Joe, given the description of the area, and I think you did a good job, very vivid there, how do you figure they're so confident?
Who knows? I'm pretty sure they're quite desperate, obviously.
I'm talking about the authorities. Why are the authorities confident they've got them finally? I've heard Vermont... You know, in my newscast, my partner Noam Layden said a Philadelphia cab driver says he may have given them a lift. I mean, getting reports all over the place. Now you're saying that they're pretty sure this is it. Why? Why are they so sure?
There was a sighting of one of the roadblocks. Saw two men run across the road into the woods last night. That's what spurred all this activity in this area. And we heard this morning, about 45 minutes to an hour ago, that there was another sighting in the area. And there's a lot of, I mean, there's tension here, Geraldo. Everything's heightened. It feels like something is about to happen.
So you really, as an experienced reporter, how long have you been on that job again, Joe?
30 years
there, you know, that's plenty of experience, more than anyone I've heard reporting on this great escape here. You're saying that the vibe you have right now is that the end is near.
Yes, but I will tell you honestly, an hour ago it was a lot stronger. It's still a lot of tension, but you know how these things go.
Yeah, so an hour ago it felt imminent, now it just feels tense.
Yeah.
Okay, I got it. Okay, put that aside. What do you make of the, you know, now it seems that everybody is confirming this theory that Joyce Mitchell, the 51-year-old tailor, the head of the jailhouse tailor shop where both these guys worked, where both, what's his name, Swede and Matt worked, that she was a tramp, according to her ex-husband, and she was more than capable of being seduced by Matt and helping Swede, and that what went wrong is she was supposed to be the getaway driver. At the last minute, she chickened out and admitted herself to the hospital with tension. I mean, is that the generally accepted story now, that she helped engineer the whole thing with these guys because she was seduced by Matt, chickened out, left them flat when they got out? She wasn't there to drive the getaway car. Is that, do you, Joe Lotemplio of the Plattsburgh Press Republican, do you buy that story?
It seems to be so. I mean, everybody is talking about it. Everybody's reporting it. Police are not denying it. And we've talked to family members of hers, in-laws, who, you know, have talked a little bit about her. And there have been some friends that have known her and the family for a while. And let's put it this way, nobody's denying it.
Nobody denies. I guess her son says that it could never have happened, but the ex certainly hasn't helped her case. Joe Lotemplio, Joe, call us the second anything breaks. Well, we'll call you if we hear anything. Let's give our audience, first crack at this thing. Thank you. Excellent reporting. You broke a lot of news on this, Joe, and I appreciate your help and everybody else at the Plattsburgh Press Republican. Thanks, Joe.
You can call me J-Lo. I'm the original.
You got it, J-Lo. I like that spirit. I like that spirit. Let me take a break here. I got an important thing I want to bring up because I had, my son is here because Cruz and Lauren are having a second baby. So we have a baby shower. So all the children have come. Gabriel from California. Nice. Cruz is up from Texas. Everybody's getting together. Gabriel is a real... he's a Gen Xer. He's mid-30s now. He has a real, you know, totally into the computer thing. He has a real feel for what the kids are saying. And we talked a lot about racism and about this stuff with the blacks and cops and everything that's going on. And I started thinking about it. Commissioner Bratton was talking about it in a general sense. The First Lady of the United States talking about it. Both of them almost at odds with what they saw as the big problem. I want to talk about that very importantly and get your feedback, ladies and gentlemen, at 866-HERALDO. You're listening to 77 WABC. We shall return right after this. Welcome back. 25 minutes after 10 o'clock. This is what I want to talk about for the rest of this first hour, and this is what I want to hear from you on. I think this is the issue that will determine whether or not this is a summer that we remember for the good old days, or a summer we remember as one going back to the bad old days. Let's start with that graphic video out of Texas. The police corporal, Eric Casebolt, stupidly drawing his weapon on a bunch of unruly black children in bathing suits. As you know, the cop resigned on Tuesday because a tidal wave of criticism washed over his McKinney, Texas Police Department. See, doesn't this prove how cops devalue young black lives, this cop drawing his gun on these children? Isn't this a thankfully less violent example of the hostility between black and blue? Isn't this part graphic evidence, the tension that's led to the bloodshed in Ferguson, Missouri, on Staten Island, Charleston, South Carolina, Baltimore, most notoriously maybe? Then you look again at the same video of that cop drawing his 9mm on those bratty kids. Why weren't those children obeying the cop's demands to cease and desist? I mean, I don't want to sound too crotchety, but I tell you, in my day, that kind of disrespect for authority would have been inconceivable. How much of the blame for many of these tragic deaths and these encounters between cops and young black men, young brown men, how many of these deaths are the result of the victim simply disobeying and disrespecting the cop's authority? Why didn't Michael Brown in Ferguson, why didn't he listen when the officer questioned him? Couldn't Eric Garner, right on Staten Island, couldn't he have easily avoided his fatal confrontation? Or even Walter Scott, who got shot in the back in South Carolina. Why did he run away from the cop? Why did Freddie Gray run away from the cop in Baltimore? Where were they going? So you have two powerful public figures, as I said, speaking their minds yesterday, diametrically opposing points of view about what ails urban America, and more specifically, why are we suffering, ladies and gentlemen, this growing, gaping divide between cops and civilians? Why so much hostility? So first you have the police commissioner, Bill Bratton. He's waxing philosophical. He's with John Gambling, the well-known radio host. Yesterday, the commissioner blaming the disorder on a breakdown in traditional American family values. Here's the commissioner.
This is not a police issue alone. This is a societal issue. And we're starting to reap what has been sown over the last 40, 50, 60 years with homes dissolving and homes without parental guidance. It's an issue. It's also reflected by the fact of the still very troubling poverty rates that we have, the high unemployment rates, and particularly you can see in our city where you have high unemployment, high poverty, poor housing, poor schools, you have crime.
So the commissioner goes on to say there's just less respect for authority, and he says, quote, "My average police officer in the street would tell you that he is encountering more resistance to his or her authority, and that's inappropriate because it ratchets up what they have to do to get acquiescence to things they are attempting to enforce." All right, so that's the police commissioner. He says the breakdown in families and in the value of, traditional value where people told, cops told someone to do something and they did it. So you have the other important public person speaking out on what ails us is the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama. Our pal, Peter Baker, today's New York Times, he reports how the First Lady spoke passionately at a prep school commencement address Tuesday. She spoke to the graduating class of kids, all of them young black kids from King College Prep High School in her hometown neighborhood, Chicago South Side. And Mrs. Obama telling the graduates how even being the First Lady living in the White House does not protect the Obamas from the sting of racial misunderstanding, including, this is a quote, "insults and slights directed at her husband and herself. Was I too loud, too angry, too emasculating?" The First Lady asks, "Was I too soft, too much of a mom, not enough of a career woman?" Here's the First Lady.
"Maybe you've been tested a lot more and a lot earlier in life than many other young people. Maybe you have more scars than they do. Maybe you have days when you feel more tired than someone your age should ever really feel. But graduates, tonight, I want you to understand that every scar that you have is a reminder not just that you got hurt, but that you survived."
There's no doubt, ladies and gentlemen, there's racism in this country. Both the commissioner and the First Lady refer to inequality of opportunity, racial stereotyping. In America, and including here in the biggest, most important, most progressive town in the country, New York City. Now I think, and this is my main goal, the commissioner and the First Lady and the camps that they represent, they have to join together in sending out the message that we're not only going to join in the fight for better education and employment opportunities, but we're also going to tell our children to respect the rules. Rules that have made this system the fairest in the land, the fairest on the planet. We have to have respect, but we have to recognize that a lot of this discord, a lot of this dissatisfaction is fact-based, not just attitude-based. What do you think? Who's right? Are they both right? The police commissioner and the first lady? I want to spend a half hour addressing the critical issue of our times. But first, Noam has the news.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down.
A great American has just come into our studio here high above Madison Square Garden. General Ray Odierno will be introducing the Chief of Staff of the United States Army at the top of the hour. But now, as promised, I want to take the next 20 minutes or so to talk about what in the world is happening. You have a breakdown in respect toward policemen. The cops are, as a result, demoralized, many of them, says the commissioner. And if it's bad here, you can imagine how it is in towns like Baltimore, where they have essentially said, go at it, kill each other. It's very, very distressing what's happening. The lack of respect shown the cops, the fact that people not listening to the authorities, and the commissioner blaming it in part on the breakdown in the urban family. We'll talk about that. What do you think? Who's right? Is it the first lady who says that racism is still the force that is keeping people disadvantaged? Or is it the police commissioner who says it's the lack of respect and authority? Where do you fall? Debbie in Long Island, you're first at 866 or older. What are you thinking?
Hi, this is Debbie. I'm a teacher, and I see the problem mostly with a lack of respect of kids and parents. Our culture seems to be today much more disrespectful to authority, whether it be a cop, whether it be a teacher. And, you know, the kids are not any better to their own parents. When we have kids who talk back to teachers or disgusting to the principals call the parents yell at them, curse at them, and, you know, it's a two-way street. It's very, and there are no consequences for the kids because the parents don't see anything wrong with what their kids are doing. And, you know, this is, our culture is having this problem. You see it with road rage as well. There's no, everybody wants to do their own thing, say their own thing. They don't care. And there's no control.
Do you see any difference racially?
It's really out of whack.
Well, do you see any difference between the black families, brown, Latino families, white families?
No, I think it's all. It's white, black, Latino, it's everything. No one has respect. Kids can talk any way they want to a teacher.
Is there anyone who can change that, Debbie?
Anyone who can change it. There has to be a cultural change. I really don't know. I mean, we're, as teachers, we're throwing our hands up. I don't know. I'm really at a loss. They're just, you know, kids just speak their minds in any disgusting fashion they want. And when you call their parents, the parents do the same thing.
Who do you turn to? Who will be the model? Debbie, excellent call. I appreciate it. Here's David in New York. Thank you for calling. David, what's on your mind, buddy?
All right, Geraldo, I'm about to say something that may be a little explosive, and sorry about that. But I think we're all speaking euphemistically when we talk about, including the First Lady, when we talk about minorities and discrimination that they suffer and the difficulties that they have. I would like to note that all of these incidents don't involve people, all people of color. In this city and nationwide, Latinos, Asians, folks from the Middle East, such as Pakistan, Afghanistan, have all integrated really well into this society. Even after one generation, I mean, nobody could be more high-striving and more high-achieving than Asians. Latinos have integrated fully into this society within the space of my lifetime. All right, I'm not that old, but I'm up there. the folks from the Middle East, et cetera. You see them working hard.
Okay, get to your bottom line, David. I see where this is leading. Make your point.
The bottom line is that the issue between the police and the so-called minority communities is really the issue of police and the black community. And I think that it's time that America confronts what and discusses honestly what is happening in the black community that sets it apart. It's the vestige from slavery is it some other cause, but we can't keep pretending that this country is racist against people of color. It isn't. And I think the facts demonstrate that.
And yet, David, you can't deny that a kid being born to one of those broken families in Harlem doesn't have the same shot as, someone born to an intact family on the Upper East Side.
I agree. The question is, why are people in Harlem having kids that have no dads in the house and they can't afford? Other minority communities, other races that are people of color don't do that.
All right, I appreciate the call, David. It is an explosive observation. True or not, you have to tell me, ladies and gentlemen. Here's Jocelyn in the Bronx. What's up?
Hello.
Hi, Jocelyn. You're on. What are you thinking about?
Yes. I think it's the way the kids are raised from their young. I believe from 2 or 3 years old, when they can understand, you should let them know no means no. And I agree with the first lady that her mom is taking nonsense from her and her brother. And I think parents have to start being parents.
And so when the first lady, Jocelyn, says, even my family, even the first family of the United States experiences caricatures and insulting remarks they called the first lady Obama's baby mama and he said she was one of his cronies of color. I mean, that sounds pretty intense, if true, and I have no reason to doubt the first lady. Most people think of more fondly of her than they do even of her husband. Does the first lady have a point, Jocelyn?
I think she does have a point. I think she do, because I'm almost 60 years old, and I'm from Antigua. And I have seen the kind of talk towards basically black that have authority or black that has done well for themselves. And I've seen even in the media that they kind of talk down, to these people. So I agree with her.
But on the other hand, does the guy who just called have a point in saying that this is this disrespect for authority is uniquely a black thing?
Well, I believe he has a point. And again, as I said, sometimes there's no authority in the home and the kids figure they could go to school and do they behave the same with the teachers or the police that's in authority. At the same time, the police has to be the bigger person and show some kind of restraint. Because that episode in Texas, I mean, I didn't say the kids basically were all right, but the girl that the police put on the ground, that was outrageous behavior by the police. And that should have never happened.
But shouldn't that girl have respected the policeman's authority and not even let it get that far?
Taking side.
I got you. You're a wonderful lady. You're so thoughtful, and I bet you're a great mom if you are a mom. And I just appreciate your call. Thank you for listening.
You're welcome.
Okay. I'm going to take one more, and then we'll get a break going on. Here's Gus in Jersey. What's up, Gus?
How you doing, Geraldo?
Okay.
I hear all these people talking, and it's all sound a little racially biased to me.
Even the black lady you just heard from Antigua?
Oh, well, you guys asked your question, but I've been here a long time. I'm 65 years old with you.
So you can hang out with me, but what are you thinking about?
Well, see, all this in the black community was started at all was when, back in the day when I was an officer, we got a letter from the feds from the West Coast about the crack being brought in from South America and was specifically given to the Bloods and the Crips on the memo from them. They knew who gave it to them. They knew who was in between, which was the Hells Angels, supposedly gave it to the Bloods and the Crips.
Why did you quit the force, Gus? Why did you quit?
Because of that.
Because you thought the authorities were conspiring against the black community?
They did. I've seen the letter myself.
I have to say that my son and his generation believe that. Do you know about that COINTELPRO memo that Gus, thanks, and thanks for your service.
You can look it up on your laptop.
We shall.
Google, Ali North.
I remember the charge, however outrageous. You know, let me take a break. What do you think? I'm going to go one more on this. I know I want to talk about this all summer. I want to give you a fair warning right now. I want to try to be helpful. I don't just want to bitch about stuff. I want to try and see what we can do. I was thinking the other day, maybe we need the old WPA back. You know, in the Depression when they had these Job Corps programs. Why don't we have these kids, hire them to make sidewalks or something. Give them something positive to do where you pay them. I mean, it seemed to me that the federal budget is better spent on that kind of stuff than some of the bureaucratic waste that goes on in these these sweetheart deals that they do to pass the money around lobbyists in D.C. It's 49 minutes after 10 o'clock at the top of the hour. The Chief of Staff of the United States Army joining us live. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Geraldo, the truth behind the story for New York. Live, local, on it. 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
4 minutes away from hearing from the Chief of Staff of the United States Army. You know, there's a new deployment, almost 500 GIs heading to Iraq. How do you think about that? What do you feel about that? Is that enough? What should they do? Are we on the verge of escalating that conflict back to the bad old days? We're also celebrating the Army's 240th birthday, 1775. It got started. Let me squeeze John in here on our topic, and this is a topic I promise you we're going to stay with all summer long. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good, man.
Listen, I happen to agree with the commissioner and with one of your calls there. I don't think that this is a white person issue. I think it's a black community's issue. It's their issue. We've been throwing money at this poverty for 60 years and nothing's changed. Unless we restore the family in the black community, nothing's going to change. You can throw all your programs you want at it. Nothing's going to change.
I hope you're wrong about that, John, but I tell you, a lot of people feel that, and we'll continue this topic tomorrow. We'll be right back.
March along. Sing a song with the Army of the Free. Count the brave, count the true, who have fought to victory. We're the Army and proud of our name. We're the Army and proudly proclaim. First to fight for the right and to build the nation's might. And the Army goes rolling along.
Seven minutes after 11 o'clock. And I am delighted. I urge you, if you can, get your computer on, watch the podcast, 77 WABC. His chest has more ribbons on it than you'd ever see. And we call him the big man. We call him the big man. He is the 38th Chief of Staff of the United States Army. We welcome proudly to our studio high above Madison Square Garden, General Ray Odierno. How are you doing, General?
I'm doing great, Geraldo. Thanks for having me.
It's terrific having you in town. You're here, the big occasion Friday, the Army's 240th birthday. You know, what's the significance? I mean, tell us, give us some context.
Well, I mean, for us, obviously, in 1775, this Army was established, before our nation was, fought to establish what we have today in this great country, a great nation of ours, and we have people that have been serving for a very long time in every conflict to preserve our freedoms and our liberties that our forefathers initially established. So we think it's important to think about that every year and the sacrifice that those who have served in the Army, the millions and millions of men and women who have served in this great Army of ours, and we think it's important to celebrate the birthday of this great institution.
When we met you, first of all, you have a local connection. You were brought up in, before you went to West Point, New Jersey.
Yeah, in Morris County in Rockaway, New Jersey. So I'm local. Grew up right outside of New York City, so it's always like coming home when I come here.
When we met you, you had a mere 2 stars. You were the commanding general of the 4th Infantry Division in Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown. It was your GIs who found the Iraqi dictator in his rabbit hole. How do you feel when you see fighting, bleeding over that same territory, that same turf.
It's frustrating. I think back when I was the overall commander in Iraq, I left in late 2010, and when I left, we had brought security back to Iraq. It was as calm as it had been. The economy was growing, and so I really felt like we had got it to a place that would make it a contributor in the Middle East. But when we removed all of our troops out of there, the Iraqis simply, frankly, continued to not be able to get along, and they've alienated and fractured as a country. And what that meant was organizations like ISIS exploited that opportunity. They exploited this divide that was happening inside of Iraq. So we've seen it deteriorate quite significantly since 2013.
I was honored to be in the last convoy out in 2011.
Yeah.
And I was glad to put it behind us. And as we were leaving that last base heading for Kuwait, I saw all these civilians, unruly civilians, breaking over the gate to steal the pickup trucks we were leaving behind and to loot the ammo dumps and everything else going on. The Iraqis, does Iraq really exist as a nation? Isn't it just the Shiites versus the Sunnis versus the Kurds? Is it a nation there at all?
Well, I think that's the question. And you have different groups that have different ideas of what Iraq should be. You know, frankly, Iraq was a country drawn on a map a long time ago by the British. And frankly, they've had struggles ever since then, and we're continuing to see that play out. The problem today is that you have these extremist groups with radical ideas that are now starting to control some of the areas, which is dangerous to the people of Iraq who live there, which is dangerous to the region, and ultimately, in the long term, could be dangerous to the United States.
Did I hear in your voice, General Odierno, General Ray Odierno is my guest, the Chief of Staff of the United States Army, a brilliant commander. We saw him with 2 stars, with 3 stars, now with 4 stars. Did I hear in your voice when you left as commander of all Iraq in 2010, we had that fight won? Is the blame on the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, for pulling everybody out in the very next year and allowing it to go to hell in a handbasket?
I think that's too easy to say. I think it's much more complicated than that. In order for Iraq to be successful, it's about security. It's about having a government that can govern for all the people. And we were given all the assurances that the Iraqi government would, in fact, reach out to all these communities. And so we really believed that's what was going to happen. But frankly, a short time after we left, all of a sudden, Prime Minister Maliki started arresting all the Sunni leaders. So they didn't live up to their promises.
So it's just, instead of Iraqis, the Shiites became Shiites again, and they went after the Sunnis.
There's this historical mistrust that goes back to Saddam Hussein and before, where the Sunnis took advantage of the Shia. Now you have the Shia taking advantage in some ways of the Sunnis because they fear each other. And frankly, this plays out not only in Iraq, but it's playing out throughout the Middle East now. And it's, Iran, Saudi Arabia, it's some people call it Arab against Persian, some people call Sunni against Shia. And that's the underlying factor that's playing out across the entire Middle East.
So how the hell can we sort it out, Jack?
Well, that's the problem. It's complex. And in my opinion, the Arabs and the Persians have to be part of this. The Arabs have to help to solve this problem with ISIS. And that's why we should not go in there and do it ourselves. They need to lead. We certainly should support them and help them because, as I said earlier, it could impact Europe. It could impact the United States in the future. We did it once, and it took us longer than we expected. It cost us more lives than we thought it would to do it. We did it, and we handed it to them in a way that, in my mind, could have really moved forward in the right way. We shouldn't make that mistake again. They have to take this on. I think we should support them where we can, but I think we should be very careful in getting embroiled in this again, unless we believe that sometime in the future there's a direct threat to the United States.
Putting aside that ominous future, Right now, you have a total with the 450 that the president has authorized now to go into Anbar province. There's a total of 3,550 GIs in Iraq. When you were commander, you had over 100,000. You beat them. Is ISIS winning right now, General Ray Odier?
Well, I would say first, winning, no. I mean, I think they, so I will say, what I will say, back when this started in 2013, they surprised us by the ability of how fast they were able to take control of some of the areas, not in Syria and Iraq. So you get, they're not disconnected. Iraq and Syria are connected in this way. And what they've done is they took advantage of the problems in Syria. They've taken advantage of the problems in Iraq. Since we have provided air support, since we have provided trainers, they frankly in the last couple weeks, they've regained some of the things that they had lost. We have taken out a significant amount of their leadership. So I wouldn't say that they have gained since this all started. What I would say, though, is recently they have made some gains.
ISIS
in the Sunni areas. And it's because, frankly, that we have not, you know, the government of Iraq has not yet convinced the Sunnis to take up arms against ISIS. They don't like ISIS, but they have not yet, they're not convinced that the government will continue to support them if they fight ISIS.
Which don't they like worse? Do they dislike ISIS, well, which is their religion, Sunni, or they dislike the Shias in Baghdad?
Well, but ISIS is not their religion, Sunni. ISIS is an extremist version of their religion. And what they do to the citizens is horrible. And so there is no good alternative right now. There is no good alternative for them. And I think in a lot of ways, that's the difficulty of this conflict. That's the difficulty of what's going on. So the 450 soldiers that the president approved to go in is aimed specifically at training Sunni fighters. The issue we've had is getting Sunni to volunteer in order to be trained. And so what we're doing is we're trying to make the training closer to them and opening up training areas. So we're increasing the number of training areas that hopefully will help them to come in and allow them to be trained and then become part of the solution. But it's going to be difficult if we don't have the leadership within the Iraqi security forces, the army, and the political leadership that supports them and will help them and ensure that they will become full, true citizens of Iraq.
Instead of just Sunnis or just Shiites. Okay, I'm speaking live with General Ray Odierno, the Chief of Staff of the United States Army. He's in New York to celebrate the 240th birthday of the United States Army. He grew up listening to 77 WABC. Who is your favorite DJ?
Well, it's Cousin Brucey.
Cousin Brucey, okay. He watched the submarine races on the West Side Highway. General Odierno is live after this.
77 WABC. Traffic and transit.
An accident on the New York State Thruway northbound as you approach South Nyack. Not really causing any major delays. Just know that it is there. Also in the Bronx, there's a disabled vehicle on the Major Deegan Expressway northbound at 138th Grand Concourse. That's in the right lane. Traffic stop and go from Brook Avenue. And we still have that stall on the BQE eastbound at Astoria. It's in the right lane and slowing you from 30th Avenue. There's also some road work to be aware of on the Cross Island Parkway northbound near Hempstead Avenue. That's in the left lane. Should be picked up by 3 o'clock. And in New Jersey, Monmouth County, the Garden State Parkway southbound after Middletown. There is an overturned vehicle. It's off the roadway, but you could still run into some onlooker delays. And Rahway, Route 35 northbound as you approach Route 27. The water main break here still has the roadway reduced to one lane, so expect some slowdowns, and that should be cleared at some point later today. On the subways, there are signal problems in Manhattan at West 4th Washington Square. That is slowing down service for the F and M trains, but the mechanical problems at 96th Street have been repaired, so the northbound 1 train should be back on time soon. In Brooklyn, we still have that track maintenance going on at Coney Island Stillwell Avenue, and that is creating delays for the D trains in both directions. Checking the forecast from Channel 7's Bill Evans, 80 degrees and sunshine. Hot day ahead of us with highs at 90. Overnight, lows down to 71. And then tomorrow, it will be slightly cooler than today. Highs at 85 with partly sunny skies. Our next report in about 15 minutes. Angela Chase, right now traffic on 77 WABC.
We're continuing with General Ray Odierno, the Chief of Staff of the United States Army. Before we do, in recognition of the Army's 240th birthday, there is a great organization I want to bring your attention to. DAV, Disabled American Veterans. They've started the Keep the Promise campaign to help raise the needed funds to connect our country's 3.6 million disabled vets and 22 million other vets with the medical, financial, and educational benefits they have earned to protect our fighting to protect our freedoms. For more than 90 years, DAV has helped disabled vets injured during their service to our country live the lives with respect and dignity they deserve. It has filed more than 10 million claims on behalf of these vets. This has been done with efforts from everyday people like you and me, willing to keep the promise to America's heroes. I hope you'll join me and DAV, Disabled American Vets, in participating in the Keep the Promise Challenge, supporting the brave men and women who have served and sacrificed for our country. All you have to do is go to helpkeepthepromise.org or call 859-442-1340 and make a donation today. Again, that's helpkeepthepromise.org or call 859-442-1340. Let's show America's injured heroes that we continue to stand with them on the road to recovery. General Odierno after this short message.
Oh, and I don't want to die for you, but if dying's asking me, I'll bear that cross with honor, because freedom don't come free. I'm an American soldier, an American, beside my brothers and my sisters.
Toby Keith, an American soldier. And I'm speaking with, I have seen this man in action, a superb commander. We always refer to him as the big man. He's a larger-than-life figure. He's the chief of staff of the United States Army. We're huge fans of General Ray Odierno. Delighted to have him live in our studio. General, as I said, I have seen you in action. You are a superb battlefield commander. You know what it takes to win. So now you have the 450 troops going, but as far as I know, unless there's secret stuff going on, I'm sure there is that I'm not familiar with, but certainly not on any massive scale, are we sending artillery spotters or air traffic spotters, not sending a lot of units of special operators to go do battle. It seems that we don't want to incur any casualties. As far as I know, in this new deployment, there are no Apache helicopters being sent. There's no none of that. No plans, at least right now, to occupy that airbase with aircraft. How can we win this war? How can we even make a decisive statement with something that seems, at best, a very modest deployment of 450 GIs to go with the 3,000 already there?
Well, again, I would say that what we're trying to do is enable them to do those things, enable them to fight, enable them to overcome the ISIS threat. You know, we actually have a training program going on in Syria. You know, in order to defeat any enemy, you got to attack them across multiple fronts. So we have the Kurds in the north. We want to get the Iraqi army, the west, and moving up from south to north. And then you want to also train some people to put pressure on ISIS in Syria. So what you have to do is you have to do, once you start to do that, it puts a lot more pressure on them. So what we're trying to do is train the local indigenous forces there who have to, they're the ones who have to buy into this, and they have to be able to do this. And so what we're trying to do here is train them to take this on.
But I've never seen them win a battle without
you
know what I mean? Without the United States military effectively in command with a couple of supplemental Iraqis hanging around, I've never seen them in and of themselves as an Iraqi army win a battle.
But I think so, but we have to get them to do this, because here's my problem, Geraldo. As I said earlier today, we could put 150,000 U.S. soldiers on the ground, and we would defeat ISIS. But then what? We just go back to where we are today, 2 months later, because, or 2 years later, a year later, because they have to have the governmental structure, the social structure, the economic structure, and the military structure to sustain it. And we've done that once. I'm not willing right now, I don't think we should do that again. Now, I never say never. And there might be a time where it's so dangerous to us that we believe it's essential that we do that. I don't think we're at that point yet.
I want to, obviously, two huge issues. You don't think we are there yet. You don't think that ISIS is a threat to us yet.
Yeah, I think ISIS is a threat to the Iraqis. I think they're a threat to the immediate place they're in. Yes, they have large propaganda issues that they push out. We can deal with that with other means. if we had the authority to do that. That's a whole nother subject. What I would say is it's important for those in the Middle East. These people are coming and being generated mostly from the Middle East and other areas. They have to help to deal with it. They have to say, we're going to deal with this problem. And they have to commit to dealing with this problem. And we will help them to do that. And if they don't do that, no matter what we do, again, unless we want to go in there and have a significant presence there for a very long time.
100 years.
Yeah. We're not going to fix the problem. And I don't think we want to do that. And so what I would say is that we want to train them. We want to give them the capability. I think there's a time in the future we have to might make a decision. Do we embed some of our capability in very small numbers with them? But I think we're not quite there yet. And then after that, you know, again, if it becomes an existential threat to this country, then we have to rethink about it. And then, and we have to bring that to the president, and then he's going to have to make a decision.
I'm out of time. You've got to move on. I know General Ray Odierno going back to the big party tomorrow morning in Times Square, the Army's 240th birthday. Do we all show up and sing happy birthday, U.S. Army?
Absolutely. I think we do. We're going to have a little show there. We have some of our soldiers there who will perform and get people to understand what the Army is about and the great talent that we have in the Army, whether it be musical talent or leadership talent. We've got it in the Army.
And the one thing about the Army, the Army knows how to integrate. I'm talking about racially. I mean, the Army knows how to motivate people, black, brown, white. I mean, the Army is the most magnificently integrated.
We are incredibly diverse, and it's about performance and nothing else. If you come in, no matter where you come from, social, religious background, if you do well, you will be promoted and you'll be successful.
General Ray Odierno, thank you. Happy birthday. Colonel Jocelyn Aberle was with General Ray Odierno and me and the rest of the Fox News team in Tikrit in Iraq in 2004. She was a near. Were you a major then or were you a lieutenant still?
I was a major.
You're a major then. You're ageless. Now you're a big shot, a big colonel there in the Pentagon. So when you see that we're still fighting over the same territory, I talked to General Ray Odierno, your boss, our chief of staff of the United States Army, just minutes ago. When you see that same ground, still blood being shed, I mean, how do you feel just as a person, as a sensitive, sensible person?
Well, Geraldo, having spent over 3 years in Iraq, it's disappointing, you know, to watch and see what's going on today. But the one thing that I'm sure you'll agree is that the Iraqi people are resilient. I mean, they are such a resilient people. And hopefully, if they can get their political system straightened out and, you know, enter into a period of non-secular activity, then maybe they have a chance.
But do you think that even as you say that it's unrealistic to think that these folks will ever consider themselves Iraqi? I mean, they got the Shiites, you got the Sunnis, they got the Kurds. I mean, do they ever really want to be together in one nation?
I think it's too early to tell. I mean, and I know we're talking, it's like, well, how can it be too early because we've been in there over 10 years? But social change takes time. I mean, it takes a lot of time, and I think Iraqi's history is still being written.
So what about your history? I mean, are you going to be a general? Like, were you going to be a commander? What's your future?
I don't know. You should ask General Odierno before he left.
I think you're a superb officer, and all right, so tell me about this whole PR thing. What are you doing here with the birthday, the Army's birthday, 240th birthday?
We are thrilled to be back in New York City to celebrate the Army's 240th birthday. We love coming to New York. We had an opportunity to come up for St. Patrick's Day. And when I say we have all of our great soldiers from our elite ceremonial units stationed down in Washington, D.C.
And what are they going to be doing?
We kick off festivities at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning at Times Square down by Military Island. We have the U.S. Army Drill Team, the Fife and Drum Corps, the band. You're going to have music. You're going to have performances from the Drill Team. General Odierno is going to do an official cake cutting ceremony that we have our youngest soldier and our oldest soldier participate in. And just some great opportunity for some great entertainment. The New York Fire Department, Fife Corps is coming along to help us celebrate, and I heard that Miss America and Miss Teen America are going to be there.
Fantastic. So it's Times Square at 10 o'clock tomorrow, Friday morning. Mm-hmm. And Military Island, that's like 43rd and 7th and Broadway all come together. You can't miss it.
Correct. And you'll hear us. The Army is loud, and you'll be able to hear us.
And who's this lovely lieutenant here? Lauren Glover. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, how are you?
Now, you're the commander of the U.S. Army drill team?
I am. I'm the first female commander of the United States Army drill team.
Wow. So do you get razzed ever?
A little bit, but the guys are pretty protective, and we have a lot of fun together. So
what about, I mean, in terms of the Army changing, here you are, you're a female, you're a proud African-American woman, and you're the first ever to command the United States Army drill team. I mean, what did they say when you got that job?
I mean, you know, some people think it's political correctness. Some people think it's an experiment. You know, some people are just really proud and want to see what happens. I'm just here to do my job. I'm a platoon leader, just like I was a platoon leader before in Guantanamo Bay, just like I was a platoon leader, just like any platoon leader anywhere. I'm just here to do a job, to take care of soldiers, and I'm just going to show people that women can succeed, African-American women can succeed, military police officers can succeed in a role that we haven't been in before.
And so when you see, you know, the disorder and dysfunction in so much of civilian life, particularly in urban America, do you feel like you're a role model? Is that unfair of us to ask you to do that job?
I don't think it's unfair. I think if you live your life with a little bit of pride and you put your best foot forward every day, it shouldn't matter if someone considers you a role model, because you should be already. So I have a 7-year-old stepdaughter, and I try to be a role model for her in every sense of my life. So for someone to say that I am, it makes me proud, and hopefully I am considered one, because I think I'm doing great things.
So where is the drill team? Is it based in D.C.?
It is. We're based at Joint Base Meyer-Henderson Hall.
And then you travel everywhere, though?
Yeah, anywhere that people request us to go, we travel.
So how do you deal with being a mom with that kind of schedule?
Well, you know, my stepdaughter has her real mother, and she stays with her during the summer. And then when she comes and visits me and my husband, we spend that time with her. But we have a little bit of flexibility with our schedule. So
and is your husband also a service man?
He is. He's a military police officer as well.
Who ranks her?
He outranks me by a couple months.
So he's a lieutenant also?
He is.
So, I mean, does he ever bust your, lieutenant, I beg your pardon, but I have the bathroom first. I rank you.
not too often, but we were actually in school together, so we did have that competitiveness going on. Sometimes I would, have a better test score than him, but he'd do better in some kind of physical activity. So we go back and forth a little bit, but it makes us better. So
are you going to be like Jocelyn, like Colonel Averly? Are you going to be a general someday?
I hope to. She's a great role model, so I try to emulate.
Well, you are too, and I appreciate you coming in for the birthday. So tomorrow, what exactly will you be doing in Times Square?
I will be participating with the United States Army Drill Team. We have a great performance for everyone who comes out.
Can you pretend that we're your drill team now? Can you give us an order? Okay, what would you do? How would you do it? Go through this sequence.
You say forward march, and we march out there, and then...
If we use your real voice. Use the voice that you use. Go ahead.
Forward march! And then we start going out.
I stood up.
we give them a mark time. So mark time, march. And then from there, the drill team goes into their drill. And we actually call the drill a silent drill. And then throughout the drill from there, I only use clicks with my heels. And the guys have to listen in. And that propels the drill forward. So it's really unique to watch.
Thank you, First Lieutenant Lauren Glover, for coming in. Colonel Averly, it is a delight to see you as always. I remember fondly many of our times together overseas. Your service to your country has been so admirable, and we love you.
Geraldo, thank you so much, and we thank you for your continued support of our soldiers.
We'll be right back. Welcome back. 53 minutes after 11 o'clock. You know what's interesting, Noam Layden, is to be with these people. I met overseas in Iraq 11 years ago. So 11 years later, here we are. We're talking not only about the same nation, the same cities, Ramadi, Fallujah, Anbar province. I mean, it is to me, there is, first of all, seeing these people, and I've seen them obviously over the years many times, watch them, go up in ranks in the service to the country. So that's the upside, the good side. But just imagine if you were GI fighting in World War II, and 10 years after the victory over Japan and Germany, you were fighting Japan and Germany again.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, there's a melancholy aspect. You wonder, what the hell? And I understand the ambivalence of the president. And you saw even the general struggling for what's the mission here? What exactly, if you have the Shiites, they hate the Sunnis. The Sunnis hate the Shia. How are you ever going to get these people to live together? And when you look at how it's led to all this violence, you know, God forbid something like that happens along racial lines or ethnic lines here in this country. We've got to stay one country, stay on the same page. We've got to work this out, this whole issue of how police are relating to the minority community.
You know, well, I think we do a much better job, obviously, here.
Obviously.
I mean, and I don't know if we're the people, and I think the general, first of all, it was great to meet the general. That's my first four-star general, so that was a great moment for me, just personally.
And he's the four-star general.
Yeah, and he's the four-star general, and couldn't be a more kinder person to talk to. But I don't think it's up to us, to bring the two sides together.
In Iraq.
We're not going to do it. We don't know, as much as we think we know about them, but the history and the animosity between the two sides goes back so many thousands of years. We're not the ones to do it. Unfortunately. And I think the general was right. He says, unless it affects us directly, maybe we need to pull back a little bit.
So what does that mean? That mean you just putter along with 3,500 troops there, just enough to prevent the fall of Baghdad?
I think so, unfortunately. I mean, it's sad because you think instantly my mind goes to the thousands of peoples on our side who are lost and the hundreds of thousands on their side who have lost. And here we are in the same place again.
You know, I basically agree, and I hate to be equivocal about military matters, but the one thing I will say, and I didn't bring it up to the general, I didn't want to put him in an embarrassing situation, Iraq is Iraq. You're right, they have to figure it out. It's not our job to make them figure it out. They've got to figure it out. There is, apart from that, though, I'm a street fighter. They cut off our people's heads. They stole our stuff. They are killing Christians. They are raping, you know, people that are different faith. We have to have an aspect of revenge here.
I guess, but they weren't doing any of that until we got involved. Most of those things. They weren't cutting off Americans' heads when Saddam Hussein was in charge. They weren't.
They
didn't exist, but there was nobody doing any of that to us. They had their eyes trained on other people, not Americans. And now, unfortunately, their eyes are trained on us.
I want revenge. I want every ISIS leader who was in control and command at the time they committed these atrocities against Americans, I want them dead.
Okay, but let the Iraqis kill them instead of us.
The Iraqis have to take care of the Iraqis. That's separate from my beef with ISIS. I want to kill them. They killed us. I want to kill them. I mean, and I hate to end the program on such a militant note. And I really do believe that the big issue is our, you know, we've got to take care of our own domestic affairs. We've got quite a mess, and summer is coming. It's like the opposite of Game of Thrones. There they're worried about winter. Here, we're worried about summer. Tomorrow.